go. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Here we are. Thorn in the Side Thursday is here for the first full week of April. This is The Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. That's where you go if you want to check in with the chat room. Folks beginning to wander in. It's just a couple of us at the moment, but more will be by presently, I've no doubt. Good evening, Jeremy in Vermont. Jeremy letting me know loud and clear on TuneIn. Thank you. I do appreciate that. Because internet being internet, there's really no way to monitor on air without losing one's mind because of the latency of said interweb tubes. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid, and this is, like I said, Thorn in the Side Thursday for the ninth day of April 2015. This day, of course, we celebrate the end of the ugly outburst of treason 150 years ago this day, in which old Morris Robert decided he'd finally had enough of having his ass whipped by the country against which he committed treason. So, I don't know how you would celebrate such a thing, but celebrating is probably in order. Good. This is, of course, as always noted, a listener-supported operation, and thank you very kindly to John in Vermont, who helped us out monumentally. We ended the night last night with a $75 shortfall. And thanks to John, we enter the evening now only needing to raise our usual nightly $150 plus 25. So $175 and we're good to go this evening. Which means that, for the remainder of the week, $325. PayPal interface is at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com under the tab Contribute. You know all of this, of course, but we do this at the top of the show, okay? And no worries about filling out some of the more intimate details in the PayPal-enforced field there of the PayPal interface. You know, the one field that wants to know about that time great-grandfather went to the podiatrist to have his corns removed. You can leave that one. You can leave that one blank. It's all just about, you know, getting to the next screen. So there we are. Try to raise $175 this evening. I have a programming question for tonight and for tomorrow evening. Tomorrow evening, of course, it will be Friday on the front porch. And given the fact that our dear friend Malloy and his lovely wife Kathy, and, well, they've been away this week, and they will not be on the air tomorrow evening. I was wondering if anyone would be interested in yet another epic six-hour Friday on the Front Porch marathon. Those things have proven to be kind of fun, and it affords people who aren't around for the ordinary broadcast schedule to get in on it. So just let me know. Shoot me an email. Message me in chat or on Facebook or on Twitter, all the myriad, you know, you can stand out on the back porch and scream if you want to. That's not necessarily a guaranteed receipt, but it might be worth the try. Who knows? But let me know if y'all will be into an epic six-hour Friday on the Front Porch tomorrow evening. Opportunity to let a whole bunch of folks participate who might not otherwise be able to. Like I said, folks wandering into the chat room, good evening, Anatole. Good evening, Jeremy. Good evening, Ron in Canada. Good evening, Texas T. And good evening to chat room moderators, longtime, inveterate, indefatigable Lottie and Mankay. In fact, we may have a technological advance tomorrow evening. Man Cave may be running the Horn Malloy Skype chat group from the Man Cave. There's been some significant technological upgrades going on out in said Man Cave, and that may be where it comes from, which is cool. Hi, Barbie. Joining in via Skype chat. She says, 6 hours of Friday on the front porch. I vote yes, as does Steve in New York City. And Steve also says, I can't do as much as I want, but here's a $10 challenge. Steve will double the first 10 bucks that come in to help knock down that $175 fundraising goal. Thank you. Thank you very kindly, Steve. Very kindly indeed. So that's two votes for an epic Friday on the front porch. We'll see how many other votes we get. Oh, let's see here. Well, being as how this is Thorn in the Side Thursday, I think we can. We might begin with, how about this, an installment from the Department of, well, that didn't take long. Did we have an Andrea tarantula sighting last week? I can't remember, but I think she's just trying to, she's attention starved. I don't know if her parents treated her like B.F. Skinner did his kid by keeping her in a box or something. But clearly, Andrea Tarantula is hungry for attention. And since we can give it to her just because she works so hard at being an ignorant dingbat. You hate to let all that hard work go to waste. Okay, two more votes. Jeremy in Vermont and Haley in Arkansas voting for an epic Friday on the front porch tomorrow evening. I just need to know this kind of thing in advance because one has to gird up one's broadcast loins. No, you don't want the mental image of that. I apologize for that in advance or immediately after the fact. But you got to build up a wellspring of... I mean, you got to lay in a supply of water and snacks and little doodads and stuff like that. You know, 6 hours, right? Yeah. So, no, we can't. Jeremy says, epic six-hour Friday on the front porch makes for a great listen at work bright and early Sunday morning. My own version of church, if you will. Well, I kind of hate being compared to a church, being how they're... But whatever works. So there, yeah. So far it looks good, but we're gonna need a rousing Horn Malloy Skype chat group in order to pull this off. Okay, so you know that yesterday we got the news that Chokhar Tsarnaev was found guilty on all 30 federal charges stemming from the Boston Marathon bombing. Yeah, he will either be killed in the name of the state or will spend the rest of his natural days in a little tiny cell, probably in Florence, Colorado, from which he will be allowed out for 2 hours out of something like 2 hours out of every 24, giving him the other 23 in which to ruminate upon the horrors of his actions. Yeah. Or maybe ruminate on whether or not he should have presented any kind of a defense. Right. Because they didn't. Suffice to say, that over at Fox News TV Radio Rwanda, what with the poll numbers running about 80-20 against giving Chokar Tsarnaev the horizontal crucifixion in the name of the state. Well, the folks over at Fox News TV Radio Rwanda never want to miss a chance to encourage a little bit of bloodletting. I mean, one gets the notion that Andrea Tarantula would like to maybe, I don't know, chew him to death or something if she could. No, sorry, Jeremy. Thanks for playing, but he says, in the name of the government, Bob, Massachusetts has no death penalty. Sorry. If Chokar Tsarnaev is horizontally crucified, it's going to be done not just in the name of the people of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, but in your name, Jeremy, and in mine, and in everybody in the Horn Family Commune Congregation, and frankly, in the name of everybody in the new United States of America. America. Because Wolverines are always free, or something like that. So, yeah, make no mistake. We have a federal death penalty. That's why we horizontally crucified. Wow, where'd that go? Timothy McVeigh. See? Yeah. Well, anyway, Fox News TV, Radio Rwanda, and particularly Andrea Tarantula, never want to miss an opportunity for encouraging a good bloodletting. Crucify him! Right? Yeah, here's the proof.
They showed that, in fact, that he was a willing, active participant, planting the bomb strategically at the end where women and children are there to cheer on their family members, that the finish line, his DNA was on the bomb making, and a series of, you know, correspondence and internet messages. So this is somebody who was right up there in front with his brother. I think it's a very appropriate case for the death penalty, and I hope that they bring it back.
Yeah, I mean, I hope he fries. I know that sounds gruesome, Kennedy, but when you look at the pictures of the victim, especially that little boy...
Mm-hmm.
That, of course, is Andrea Tarantula earning her name. Let's go back.
I hope he fries. I know that sounds gruesome, Kennedy, but when you look at the pictures of the victim, especially that little boy...
See, she doesn't just want him to be dead. She wants him tortured to death. She wants him to suffer real good-like. Which makes one wonder if... she was to be photographed while it was going on, would we be allowed to see where her hands were? She's that disgusting. That sick. I hope he fries, she says. I guess she had to say that because there's really no good metaphor for I hope the incompetent administrator of the cocktail of lethal drugs blows out a vein, or that, I hope he pants a lot before, I hope he breaks a really heavy sweat, or I hope that he goes into seizures, or I hope he fries. Stay classy, Andrea Tarantula. Stay classy.
Mm-hmm. That was gruesomely murdered, and you see how many counts he was convicted on. I mean, it's not...
Time out. And this is just because I'm a long-time knower of words. Gruesomely murdered. Kind of up there with brutally raped. Isn't any adjective you want to hang in front of a word like murdered superfluous? I mean, gently murdered? Compassionately murdered? Gruesomely murdered. You know what using a word like gruesomely in front of murdered means? It tells us a whole lot more, because pretty much everybody knows what went down at the Boston Marathon bombing and the horror that was. It tells us that psychologically, Andrea Tarantula has thought about the bombing. She's visualized it. She's put herself in a space to imagine it. Which tells us, in fact, that she is a really, really disturbed individual. Mm-hmm. They're remaking Ghostbusters, and there was a bit of a low rent right wing hissy out there recently when they that in the remake of Ghostbusters, the Ghostbusters this time will be women people. Oh, that was intolerable, wasn't it? You know what? I want a remake of Silence of the Lambs. And I want Andrea Tarantula to play Billy Bob. It puts the lotion on its skin, and then it rubs the lotion in. I can make your life a living hell. I bet she could. Hell, I bet she wouldn't have to act. Right?
Not a gray case. I mean, it's a pretty black or white matter. And I know that people are saying, well, if he doesn't get the death penalty, he'll be a martyr. He'll be considered a martyr, and then ISIS and other terror groups will use it as propaganda.
So she's arguing with herself now? This is fun.
But I think that's the last thing we need. I mean, could...
Wait. I forgot to mention. I thought it kind of went with the territory in saying this was from the, well, that didn't take long department. Yeah, exactly. Lottie in the chat room noting, murdered. It's what Jesus would have wanted. Mm-hmm. Yeah, see, because there is that. Everybody that had done something wrong, that Yeshua, the brown-skinned Palestinian day laborer and itinerant semi-literate rabbi, ran across in the course of what is referred to as his ministry, he told them quit it and forgave them. There's the story that wasn't in the original version of Mark with the woman caught in adultery, where he says, let that person among you who is without sin cast the first stone, when they were getting ready to murder a woman for selling her body to keep herself alive. And then the rock came flying up from the back of the crowd and cronked Jesus right in the head, and the blood was running down. He looked in the back of the crowd and he said, honestly, Mom, sometimes you really piss me off. No, it didn't happen that way. But he said, let that person without sin cast the first stone. And all the upstanding, law-abiding members of the community kind of hemmed and hawed and tugged at their beards and scratched in the dirt with their sandals and shit and wandered off. And he told the woman, go and sin no more. I think it's an open question as to whether the woman was sinning in the first place, but, you know. And just since we're not even a full week past Easter, maybe it might be worthwhile noting that even if you believe this sort of thing, and I only mention this because the right wing is forever telling us, this here is a Christian nation. We love Jesus. I put my pants on. Right. So I would just note that Jesus wasn't in the business of simply forgiving the occasional petty, marginal sin. You might recall that when he was busy being arrested, Peter, whose name nickname meant rock, and I think it was a loving little nickname Yeshua gave him to reference his mental capabilities. If you read the rest of the Gospels, atne ute aitre iterpe usway. Yeah. Whips out his sword and lops the ear off of one of the people that comes to arrest Yeshua. And Yeshua picks his ear up and puts it back, and it just kind of miraculously heals it. And he says, Peter, put up thy sword, for those who live by the sword shall die by the sword. And then, having been arrested, and having been flogged, and crown of thorns, and beaten, and, up the hill he goes. And then with the nails and the crucifixion, as we've just discussed, it was not a pleasant undertaking. It certainly was not a compassionate form. Here's the fun part. If you were to apply the standards of the Constitution of the United States to crucifixion within the time frame in which it was being done, cruel and unusual punishment, you know, there's a ban in the Constitution on cruel and unusual punishment. You know what? Under a constitutional analysis of crucifixion, crucifixion's constitutional. What? Yeah. Absolutely. It's cruel. There's no doubt that that nailing somebody into a couple of cross timbers and hanging them up there to die for a few days, there ain't no getting around the fact that that's cruel. Oh, well, okay, then it can't be constitutional. Yes, it can. Because, given the fact that thousands upon thousands upon thousands of people were crucified in the ancient Roman world, there was nothing unusual about it. And therefore, if a punishment is not cruel and unusual, it passes constitutional muster. How nice, huh? Yeah. Just trivia point. I know, Lottie. Lottie in the chat room noting. Lottie says, I wish the Romans had electric chairs. I think it would be really cool to wear an electric chair around your neck. But to bring this back in time, let's understand that while he was being crucified, we are told in the Gospels that Yeshua, the brown-skinned Palestinian day laborer and itinerant semi-literate rabbi, looked down upon those who were in the process of murdering him. He wasn't quite murdered yet, gruesomely or otherwise, and I'd say that is gruesome. He looked down upon them and said, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. And then they went about their way. So, with the discussion over whether or not Jochar Tsarnaev should be executed, we find ourselves in a bit, if for anyone who takes Christianity seriously, I don't, we find ourselves in a bit of a conundrum. Our essential urge toward vengeance is strong. Assuming that this young man, when he was 17 years old, did all the things for which he was convicted. The acts are heinous and barbaric. And it is understandable that as human beings, we respond perhaps as viscerally as did Andrea Tarantula in that clip. I hope he fries. Yeah. Yeah. But for those people who take Christianity seriously, they are called to some to a standard that is considerably higher. And I think you can make the overall argument, and I certainly welcome the discussion. You can make the argument that the standards Yeshua sets forth are entirely too much for a nation state to ever be expected to abide by, and that's why states sort of modified him once they had codified him and once they had incorporated him into their statecraft. I mean, I don't know. Based on what the way Andrea Tarantula sounds there, does she want to eat him after they kill him? Barbecue him up real good? No, she wants him fried, not barbecued. Not baked, not beaned, not boiled, not broiled. She wants him fried, as Lottie notes, maybe with some fava beans and a nice Chianti. They're monsters over there at Fox. There's no getting around it. But the question remains, does a nation that calls itself Christian have any business ordering people to their deaths? And this is an intense philosophical debate. Jesus was not the first one to come up with it. You don't believe me? Go read the Symposium by Plato. It's a lot older than anything Yeshua ever said. That's why they had to grandfather Socrates and Plato into Christianity. Homo Christianicus Naturaliter, I think. A naturally Christian man. Couldn't have Socrates out there burning away in hell when there he was talking about concepts that Yeshua only got around to a few hundred years later. The Symposium makes clear that the highest form of love is to love one's enemies. Mm-hmm. So the question not only is, and this is a question for the Christians, not for me. I think Chokar Tsarnaev should be incarcerated and given an abundance of time in which to ponder the utter wickedness of his act and his participation in the larger acts as schemed and dreamed up by his big brother. I don't think he should be executed simply because I don't want that blood, not even one goddamned atom of it, on my hands. But that's me. Email coming in from Luta with regard to Chokar Tsarnaev. Luta says, I hope this doesn't sound bad, but Bob, do you think the country would have cared had they bombed the BET Awards, a reservation track meet, or maybe a Mexican siesta? Because I remember that weekend or shortly thereafter, there was a mass shooting at a black folks' block party, like 10 or so people died and a bunch injured, but we heard almost nothing about it. But I may be wrong. There's so many mass shootings these days, I get them confused. Probably because only the ones where white people die get mass coverage. But I guess, says Luta, I'm just a cynic. I don't think you're a cynic. Robert in Australia with a question. Anyone remember Ali Abbas? He lost both arms and both legs and received burns to 60% of what was left of his body. Oh, and all 13 members of his family were killed in the bombing that took his arms and legs. That bombing was, of course, carried out by the United States of America. Yeah, it's not. Yeah, Andrea Tarantula is not playing very well with the Horn Family Commune congregation. Note coming in from Steve in New York, F her, where the F was the shock of these people when Dick Cheney killed a million Iraqis. Bob, I'm getting increasingly sick of this country and society, whether it's a government that screws little people trying to just make ends meet to the hatred of anyone who qualifies as one of those people. I just can't take this country anymore. I'm ready, and I'm very serious about this, to just check out of this broken, dead corpse of a society that surrounds us. Well, check out with passport in hand, because any, you know, don't just take the ultimate checkout, Steve. Dang it. Because, well, we need you. Your voice matters. Voices of compassion and conscience are far too damned few in this country to begin with. If you need to exit stage somewhere else for another country that seems a little more humane, I mean, Canada ain't that far from where you are, then by all means do so, but continue to maintain conscience. So it's a simple question. And it's easily answered by the Southern Baptist Convention and the Methodists and the, well, you know, kill him. Give us Barabbas, right? Yeah. Oh, let's finish up with Andrea Tarantula, shall we?
We potentially be looking at a situation where he's traded if he is not put to death. I mean, them saying ISIS and...
Oh, damn, I forgot to warn you about the hockey puck. Because that was that part. Let's back up and just get it in all its context. Because, you know, sooner or later, we had to work that one in our White House into this weird little psychopathic diatribe.
Get the death penalty, he'll be a martyr. He'll be considered a martyr, and then ISIS and other terror groups will use it as propaganda. But I think that's the last thing we need. I mean, could we potentially be looking at a situation where he's traded if he is not put to death? I mean, them saying, ISIS and terrorist groups saying, free Tsarnaev, and then we're in a situation again where there's pressure to trade him? Or
I got to tell you, because I get to see the video while you're hearing the audio, her compadres on the five, or whatever it is, the loons, are all just kind of looking at her with their mouths hanging open, catching flies, going, Jesus, I didn't know she was drinking this early. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know, Carol Baker. Fried? Yeah, she wants him fried. Carol asked, beer battered? Yeah, maybe that. Well, yeah, beer battered's much more American than, say, something like maybe teriyaki. Or tempura. Although, come to think of it, she might like a little teriyaki sauce, or maybe a nice little Merlot reduction to go with him after he's been fried. You're getting this, right? Because sooner or later, this has to be that one's fault.
That's the last thing we need. I mean, could we potentially be looking at a situation where he's traded if he is not put to death? I mean, them saying, ISIS and terrorist groups saying, free Tsarnaev, and then we're in a situation again where there's pressure to trade him or free him?
I mean, no, not if he gets life without possibility of parole, but I'm torn on the death penalty. I really am. And this is something that I struggle with politically, philosophically, and morally, because...
Now, this is Kennedy Montgomery, who was one of the ones looking at her, wondering just how early she did begin drinking that morning. And, yeah, she's right. If he gets life without parole, he ain't going anywhere. He's going to be, you know, we've got a Supermax out in Colorado, which is where we park all of our really, 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 really awful people. You know, the blind sheikhs out there, the Unabombers out there, that kind of thing. But, well, do continue, Kennedy. Don't take the hockey puck out. I'm telling you, don't take the hockey puck out.
Well, in a lot of ways, I know the death penalty is wrong. It's not necessarily a deterrent. It costs a lot of money. Appeals are expensive. But there's something about this case where I don't think frying him, I don't think a firing squad, I don't think lethal injection, I don't think any of those things are bad enough for him. I actually want something far worse. Like,
oh, dear. Now we're going to get into fantasizing about it. And this is one of the arguments being put forward. It needs to be far worse. He needs to spend a long, long time and right.
I want him to be shuttered away in a cement room, surrounded by pressure cookers. And, you know, I realize that death penalty is really an all-or-nothing proposition, mm-hmm. but I'm torn, but not in this case. In this case, I really want him to die a horrific, painful, slow death.
And maybe he won't.
Man. I mean, I've heard that line in the past about the female is the deadlier of the species, but wow. I want him to die, but you got to wonder if these fox women, who were the followers of Dionysius who in their revels were said to go mad and would rip men to shreds? Was that the Maenads? They would just get into a holy frenzy and tear men limb from limb. Is that the myth, or have I got it wrong? Of course, that's a myth. This is reality. Do you think Andrea Tarantula and Kennedy Montgomery could really do it? Would they even want to wear latex gloves, or would they want to just revel in the blood? And what in the sweet name of me running is it with right wingers that they're so all fired into slaughtering people? And then they go to church. And I'll bet this doesn't even enter into the confessional, you know, forgive me, Father, for I have sinned. I have openly fantasized on national television about wanting someone to be killed really slowly and really agonizingly. Like our Lord! Kind of makes you wonder where Kennedy and Andrea Tarantula would have been in the crowd there around Golgotha, doesn't it? Nail him up! Nail him up, I say! Nail him right in! Hit it again, centurion!
Wants to die, Kirsten, so that he can be a martyr and get the 72 virgins that he was promised.
Who said it? Oh, Jesus, really? So, to recap, Andrea Tarantula thinks that if we don't fry, her words, not mine, you gotta wonder. You gotta wonder how their brains get there. If they could just kill him a little better. But then again, we gotta fry him because that Obama might trade him in a hostage swap with ISIS. Yeah. Well, apparently this is disturbing to some people. Just got a note from Robert in Morgantown. Turning you off tonight, if anyone is deserving of the death penalty, it's someone like the Boston Marathon mass murderer. Would you be so forgiving if he'd bombed an abortion clinic? May I note that Eric Rudolph, bomber of abortion clinics, is doing life without parole. And I don't think there are any programs of me out there saying, "Ooh, I want him to fry! Ooh, 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 I want to tear his flesh off with my own teephuses!" Nope, sorry, I'm pretty consistent that way. I don't want anybody killed in the name of me. You want somebody killed in the name of you? That's fine, but I'd really like a way to sort of excise myself from that process. So, because I'm a hillbilly with a microphone, I get to use this microphone to say, not in my name. You want it done in your name, that's fine. We can even have a discussion about it, but not in my name. I guess there really are people out there, you know, doing the Alice's restaurant thing. Heat dead, burnt bodies, and veins in my teeth. I mean, I want to kill. And that's okay for you. But not in my name. No. Sorry. But that seemed an appropriate place to begin Thorn in the Side Thursday, because it certainly is a thorn, and it feels right piercy, as it were. I just don't. I see. There's no. Even Kennedy Montgomery there on the five, who said that she doesn't. She said. I mean, she wants him to die real slow and real painful, like. Pick up the gun. Even she admitted the death penalty serves no deterrent purpose. Time after time after time after time, we learned that. It's not going to stop the next bomber or the bomber after that. It didn't stop Officer Slager in North Charleston. He thought he would just get away with it. Don't you know? Do I want Officer Slager to fry? Interesting. Now, this is a recent clip. The North Charleston story had already broken by the time they were on the five, and yet there's no clip of Andrea Tarantula saying, "I want that Slager to fry." And there's no clip of Kennedy Montgomery saying, "I want him to suffer for a long time while he dies." Nope. It's just not there. Wonder why. Wonder if Kennedy and Andrea Tarantula think maybe Officer Slager was cute. I don't know. Watch long enough and we're liable to find out. Well, I mean, he's got a... we couldn't do that. His wife's 8 months pregnant. Did you notice that's already been put out in the media? Put out for public consumption. The defense has already begun. A GoFundMe page for his legal defense was put up and promptly taken down. No $800,000 for you. But yeah, they and he's got a wife who's 8 months pregnant. And of course, I don't believe in collective punishment or visiting the sins of anybody on anybody else. And I don't believe in the death penalty either. No, I believe in the death penalty. I don't have to believe it. I know it's real. And I know there's lots of people in this country who love them some state-sponsored execution. And I think it really would be a crummy thing to do to a brand new little baby to, because, you know, it'd take a few years to fry him, as Andrea Tarantula likes to describe it. And it'd be a horrible, horrible thing to, you know, maybe be a 5 or 6 year old little child and have mommy come to you and explain, "Well, you know how we've been visiting daddy at the prison? Well, we won't visit daddy anymore because the people of the state of South Carolina wanted to kill him because he killed someone else."
"But mommy, how does killing daddy because he killed someone else make anything any better?"
"Well, it doesn't, baby, but See, we live in a country that has a punishment fetish, and I know this is a little too much of a concept for you to get hold of at age five, baby, but our country gets off on death.
What's get off, Mommy?
We'll talk about that when you get to puberty, son, daughter. Yeah. What a country! Goodness me. Icky, isn't it? It's terrible when we get confronted by the realities of the walking horrors that we ever so often are. What else? Oh, how about a... you've seen that bumper sticker before, I'm sure. Mean people suck. They really do. You remember back, we've talked about it considerably. You remember when Adam Lanza bumped off Mother Lanza and then got into her prepper arsenal and got a few of her freedom protectors out. Wolverines! And then went and shot up the Sandy Hook Elementary School until little six-year-old school children could not be recognized. Mm-hmm. And you know, of course, that there's a bizarre and sickening segment of our society that thinks that those little children who were chopped into chutney for the sake of the Second Amendment, well, but they didn't really, it didn't happen. One of those people is a 30-year-old by the name of Timothy Rogalski of Wallingford, Connecticut. He's a Sandy Hook truffer. Many of your Sandy Hook truffers, of course, are listeners to one of America's greatest hucksters, Alex Jones.
Alex Jones!
And Timothy Rogalski is trying to help America see the truth about how Sandy Hook was a
false flag operation
that was perpetrated by people who want to get our goons. That's why on Tuesday, Timothy Rogalski, 30 years old, of Wallingford, Connecticut, picked up the phone and dialed Sandy Hook Elementary. I just wanted to make sure there was going to be no fake shooting on the day I enroll my kid there. I just wanted to clarify that he wouldn't get shot by a fake Adam Lanza. And he said, I was wondering if Caitlin Roig could be his teacher. Caitlin Roig is a survivor of the Sandy Hook Massacre. Then he called and left a message for Dawn Hochsprung. She's the Sandy Hook principal who was also, I don't know, do we have to use adverbs? Gruesomely murdered. Nah, murdered's enough. Who was slain in the Sandy Hook Massacre. So, because we live in a world where the NSA knows all, sees all, tells nothing. They were able to find out whose phone the calls came from, and the law enforcement authorities went and paid a visit to Mr. Timothy Rogalski of Wallingford, Connecticut. And they charged him with harassment. It's a misdemeanor. They admitted him to bond in the amount of $50,000 on that harassment charge. He is presently being held in the Monroe Police Department jail. And in his own defense, he said, I guess at his bond hearing, well, I know I may have offended people, but they were words, and I made no threats. I wasn't going to do anything. Except that he already had done something. He had engaged in the intentional infliction of what is probably severe emotional distress. But the Alex Jones-led Sandy Hook Truther movement doesn't care about the agonies they inflict. They've been engaging in this for, well, December will be 3 years now. Swearing up and down that the little children who were chopped into chutney by semi-automatic rifle fire aren't really dead. That they weren't even really there. Because this country has a sickness. A broad and apparently infectious sickness. That apparently has no cure. Under the subject line, name your poison, Steve in China writes, Bob. Drawing and quartering, boiling oil, evisceration, pressing with stones, thumb screws, the Iron Lady. I don't suppose the list of torture is any more exhaustible than her enthusiasm, Andrea Tarantulas, or perhaps Kennedy Montgomery's. But I get the oddest impression just listening to her. She sounds like one of the retired sports jocks talking about trading players or treating a fantasy of execution methods as so many episodes of play-by-play commentary. But that's what it's become for them. A game. When do we get the trading cards in the bubblegum pack? Regards, Steve in China. Surprised they're not already on the market, Steve. Indeed I am. By the way, going back to North Charleston, Carol notes, we can't fry the cop. We may need to trade him for Al Sharpton when the radicals try to kill Jesus again. Carol says, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't have to. Oh, none of it has to make sense. So we are about 6 minutes before the hour. We've got the Green News report coming up from Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen. This being Thursday. And I want to send out special thanks this evening to Jim in Louisiana, Stan, packing and getting ready to head to Colorado. He took care of $100 of the $175 we're trying to raise this evening. Thank you very much, Jim. Thank you very much indeed, and safe travels to you, my friend. Earther with a message. Well, Bob, it doesn't help that they shot the Sandy Hook massacre in the same studio as the fake moon landing and the Holocaust. Yeah. I know. We have a reality problem in this country, don't we? and where the Holocaust is concerned in the larger planet. And I don't understand, really, I don't understand the nature of denialism, the psychology of denialism. Maybe one of these days we should get a really, really good shrink on here to explain it to us. So, yeah. You know, the funny thing about listening to someone like an Andrea Tarantula yearning for someone else's death is that anyone who says that is, I think, in a way, engaged in a different kind of denial, and that is the denial of human mortality generally. Because it's easy to ask the question, because, you know, Andrea Tarantula has talked about, well, about her big brother who taught her not to get drunk and go upstairs in fraternity houses and such. You may remember that. Inherent in something like what she says is the determination that she's already made that no one near her could ever commit some sort of heinous crime. But you might recall Mike's conversation from last night in which he described a woman who is, or an individual who is being charged with murder in South Carolina over a traffic accident that the person did not cause or commit. And yet, an existential hell has yawned open in that family. Would Andrea Tarantula scream, "I hope he fries," over that? I think I'm almost afraid of the answer. So the lines are open. You know what they are, I presume. If you don't, let me repeat them for you right now, conveniently. Herald, the Herald line, 304. We used to call it the Skype line, but it confuses people. 304-574-8178. Maud, otherwise known as the Gizmo line, is 304-663-4676. That's 304-663-HORN. If, without any international dialing or boundaries or anything, you want to reach the program via Skype, you can always reach out and contact me, Bob Kincaid Horn. You can reach me on Twitter, at Bob Kincaid. You can reach me on Facebook, Bob Kincaid. If you ask real nicely, like, you can be a part of the Horn closed Facebook group. No trolls. Isn't that fun? Yes. Just send a request, and one of the mods will approve it. Mm-hmm. So we'll take a little break. Light up the phones if you wish. Send an email, whatever. Ron noting, "But God, Bob, to quote Carol, have you seen that rack? She could also..." Never mind, I'm not going to do that. Ron! Bad Canadian, bad! Here we go. Break time. A little reminder for the death penalty crowd. This is the Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar. Go and tell that midnight rider. Tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter. Tell him that God's gonna cut him down. Tell him that God's gonna cut him down. Well, my goodness gracious, let me tell you the news. My head's been wet with the midnight dew. I've been down on bended knee, talking to the man from Galilee. He spoke to me with a voice so sweet, I thought I heard the shuffle of angels sleep. He called my name and my heart stood still when he said, John, go do my will. Go tell that long-tongued liar, go and tell that midnight rider, tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter, tell him that God's gonna cut him down, tell him that God's gonna cut him down. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Well, you may throw your rock, hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But as sure as God made black and white, what's done in the dark will be brought to the light. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar, go and tell that midnight rider, tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter, tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down.
It's Thursday, April 9, 2015.
I think that scientific debate should not be dumbed down.
Too late. Rand Paul is running for president.
What is the environmental platform of the Republican Party? I don't know either.
Climate change denial, a looming problem for the GOP. Melting permafrost, a looming problem for the planet. Plus,
today, L.A. Mayor Eric Garcetti outlined an ambitious plan to make Los Angeles the most sustainable big city in the country.
Greening the city of angels.
All of that and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
We won't be able to live the way we do with lights and air conditioning and heat if we don't have any emissions.
Yes, we can. You're making stuff up, Rand Paul.
If we don't have cars, we can live in the Stone Age.
Nobody says we shouldn't have cars. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi, I can already tell I'm going to get crazy this year during this 2016 presidential election debate. They're already making me crazy. You know what's amazing? I can't believe how many people read that one issue of Newsweek back in 1975 or whenever it was, talking about the possibility of global cooling, back when there were a few scientists who thought we might be heading towards a new ice age, even while everyone else, all of the other scientists, 80% of them, thought we had global warming coming. And yet, every single Republican who talks about global warming, they all read that one issue of Newsweek back in the 70s.
It's the most popular Newsweek cover, apparently, ever.
Ever, apparently. All right. What kind of news do you have to make me crazy today?
Well, to start, Senator Rand Paul of Coal State, Kentucky.
I knew you were going to start with Rand Paul.
He announced this week that he is running for the 2016 Republican presidential nomination. Like his fellow congressional Republicans, he is a climate change denier.
Anybody who's ever studied any geology knows that long periods of time, that the climate changes.
Right. Long periods of time.
Okay. I'm not sure anybody exactly knows why.
Yes, they know why. They're scientists. They know exactly why it changes over long periods of time. Volcanoes, comets hit the Earth. Yes, they know these things. Just because you don't, Rand Paul, doesn't mean that scientists don't understand it. All right, proceed, Desi.
My guess is that the conclusions that you make from that are not conclusive.
Yes, by their very nature, conclusions are conclusive. All right, really, go ahead, Desi.
Okay, so questioning how much humans are causing global warming makes Rand Paul a stage two climate denier. The five stages of climate denial are like the five stages of grief. First, they start with it's not happening. Oh, then it's not us. Next, he'll probably move on to it's not that bad. And I think that the GOP will move on to it's too expensive before next year.
Oh, yeah, that's already where they are. They think it's a question between saving the planet and saving the jobs. It's a completely false choice.
And climate change is a looming problem for the Republican Party. Polls continue to show strong majorities of Americans want politicians to act on climate change. Last month at the Council on Foreign Relations, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina admitted the GOP has a problem.
So I think the Republican Party has to do some soul searching, and we got to figure out where we are as a party. What is the environmental platform of the Republican Party?
Deny.
I don't know either. So I like to come up with one.
It's deny. That's what it is. They've already come up with one, Lindsey Graham.
Meanwhile, the planet continues to ignore politics. Up in the warming Arctic, permafrost is melting. That's releasing tons of greenhouse gases. The U.S. Geological Survey just measured it. And the good news is the permafrost seems to be melting too slowly to trigger abrupt climate change. But the bad news is permafrost emissions are still huge and will count against the total emissions we can safely emit in coming decades.
I think those conclusions are inconclusive.
But innovations are moving ahead without the GOP.
It's a vision of Los Angeles many of us wouldn't recognize. A greener city of the future where Angelenos ride bikes, take trains, or walk.
Walk? Who are you? And what have you done to my local newscast?
Well, the mayor of Los Angeles, Eric Garcetti, on Wednesday released the city's first long-term sustainable development plan, a framework that sets priorities for managing growth over the next 30 years and adapting to climate change. The plan's goals are challenging, but Angelenos are demanding it, according to Garcetti.
I don't think that I have to tell Angelenos what to do. I think Angelenos are doing it. And I'm not telling people, get out of your car and get on a bike. They're demanding that they have a safe space and places to get on their bikes.
It's a serious plan to cut air pollution and cut LA's greenhouse gas emissions by transitioning to renewable energy, increasing electric car infrastructure, solar, mass transit, affordable housing, and maximizing energy efficiency and water efficiency in all buildings.
I'm proud to live here in LA. But I'm still not walking. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. While you're there, please consider a donation to help the Green News Report stay on your public airwaves. Find us and follow us on the Facebook and the Twitters at Green News Report. From bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Walking in the lane.
Nice bumper, Brad and Desi. Nice bumper. This is the horn, 7 minutes past the hour. And, let's go straight to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program. Wait a minute. Wrong button. There we are.
Good evening.
Hey, Kevin.
Hey. Just a bit of random thoughts here. Regarding the death penalty, I've thought about this a bit. Now, whether you are a Christian or whether you are an atheist, which logically would be the worst punishment you could give a person? If you're an atheist and you believe that there is nothing past this life, you're doing the guy a favor by killing him. If he's going to spend the next 40 or 50 years in a cell, 6x10 cell, getting let out 2 hours a day or week or whatever it is, in my opinion, I'd rather be dead. And if you're a Christian, same thing. Because even if you believe in a hell, if you really want him to be punished, you have him do the 60 years in prison, then go straight to hell. And I, you know, that's just me, but I personally have always felt that if I were looking at a 60-year stretch in prison, I'd rather be dead, you know. And so that's just my thought on it. What say you?
Well, it's when you consider, Kevin, the parade of horrors that have been perpetrated through the ages, all across the planet. I mean, the Bibles, the Old Testament in particular, is full of horrifying stories. then you can look to some of the other ancient documents. Well, you know, heavens to Betsy, look at the sack of Troy as contained in the Iliad. I'm reminded of, Yitzhak Rabin who was assassinated, the Israeli prime minister, for suggesting peace might be a decent idea? He said something along the lines of, human history has been written in blood. It's time we found a better color. And I agree with that. Human life is short, often sad. Robert Frost said happiness makes up in height for what it lacks in length. And culturally, cultures have to have some way to deal with the people who violate its most basic tenets. We do that with prisons, and we seem to have a predilection for making up crimes to get people into them. This Tsarnaev was convicted on 30 different counts for 4 murders. Do we ever ask ourselves why that is? Now, I'm not saying it was wrong, but I'm asking why do we have to have that? Is it because a simple common law allegation of murder could not be made to stick?
Yep.
Because what was one of the convictions? Causing injury or death by use of a weapon of mass destruction.
Right.
Any trouble with that?
If you consider a pressure cooker,
it's a bomb. We have to use some Bush language. A weapon of mass destruction.
Right.
We've got lots of people, as Robert in Australia noted, we got lots of people that we've paid to use weapons of mass destruction.
Right. Yep.
And apparently, it's deeply complicated for me. Not the issue of should this guy be punished, insofar as he is guilty of having done what he did, of course. Because I'm lucky. I'm not a Christian. I don't have to subscribe to loving my enemies. Apparently most Christians don't either. Because it's a tall order. It's almost superhuman. It's nigh unto impossible. But, you know, they're not my standards. I don't have to live up to them. The Christians do. I think what I'm getting at, if I can distill it, is that punishment should be meted out. Do you know how in parenting, one of the first things, even among those who say you should beat disobedient children, you know, like James Dobson, even those people will say, you know, you never want to inflict punishment on your child when you're angry.
Sure.
Is it safe to make that applicable to punishments meted out in the name of you and me? In other words, if the punishment that we mete out for a Timothy McVeigh or a Unabomber or a Blind Sheik or a Dzhokhar Tsarnaev, if it's meted out in fury, is it somehow flawed? Is it an act that by which we avail ourselves of our baser natures?
Short answer, yes, because there's that lust for revenge, and I've got so many thoughts, because you talk about a weapon of mass destruction. A gun is a weapon of mass destruction. Just a simple six-shooter.
It was certainly a weapon of mass destruction in the hands of, well, there we go, Adam Lanza.
Right, exactly. And then when you get into talking about punishing a criminal in anger, you get in, Adam Lanza, for example. There was a reason he was like he was. Aside from the mental illness, the issues that go around how he was raised, what he was taught, and those in legal terms are mitigating factors. And so if Adam Lanza had lived, would there have been too many people who would have cared how Adam Lanza was brought up? Would there have been too many people who would have thought, gee, maybe the problem isn't Adam Lanza himself, it's what we're teaching our children? And, when you talk about punishing people in anger, in a general sense, as a nation or as a community that does that, it doesn't allow the community or nation to pause to reflect on the causes of the crime that happened in the first place. And I find that troubling, because you talk about it somewhere. We're a nation that likes to imprison people for I get the emails about wanting to have a family member pardoned who's been in jail for 55 years for a nonviolent marijuana offense, which I find repulsive that we would put somebody in prison that long for something that minor. But it goes beyond that, of course. It goes to all crimes, all people. And our criminal justice system is not equal, aside from the non-equality in terms of the racial inequalities. Sentencing is never equal. Now, maybe it never can be by virtue of the fact each crime is unique, but one guy convicted of, say, felony assault might get 5 years, and the same guy who commits an almost exact same assault, he'll get 10 years. And I'm not even talking about the racial part of it. I'm just talking about the differences between judges who impose sentence. And I guess as I get older, the more it troubles me. Because it's something. I don't have anybody that I know of that I'm related to that's in prison. But I've sure known a lot of people that have been in prison at one time or another, just hearing the stories.
Well, I don't make reference to Christianity because I like to bash Christianity. I make reference to Christianity because there is an express set of rules there that, granted, has been modified along the way by people who weren't Jesus.
Right.
But for instance, when he delivers that famous line about, if you've done it unto the least of these, you've done it also unto me, and if you've not done it unto the least of these, you've not done it unto me. One of the things he says is, I was in prison and ye did not visit me.
Yep.
Okay. Notice what's missing there, Kevin. He doesn't say, I was in prison unjustly accused, or I was in prison falsely convicted, or yep, I was in prison oppressed, or I was in prison politically persecuted.
Yep.
He just says, I was in prison.
Yep.
It's a simple call for mercy and compassion. Now, Does anybody here doubt that Andrea Tarantula probably considers herself a good God up fearing Bible believing Christian? I'm sure she does. Anybody want to run with the rent money to Vegas on how long it is before she goes to visit Chokar Tsarnaev in prison? Because, you know, the other thing he said, you know, maybe he's Muslim, who knows. The other thing he didn't say was, I was of your faith sect, and you visited me not.
Right.
There's no qualifiers there.
No.
And
the story of the Good Samaritan. I mean, that's a story about someone who was despised at that time by the Jews, and that Samaritan was the only one that helped the person in the parable in trouble. Well, that should be a lesson to Christians that's probably overlooked way too much. I mean, why is it that non-Christians can look at the faith message of just the words of Christ and draw more meaning out of it than a good deal of many of the Christians that I know? Because I'm not there to the point of atheism, but I'm there with a lot of rage and anger against what I see in Christianity today, and I'm not a member of any congregation, church, etc., because of what I see. Not all congregations are like that, obviously, but I just grew weary of the game, you know. If I want a social club, there's plenty of them, and, you know, I hate to say I wouldn't call myself a Christian, because I call myself a believer in the words of Christ, or in the words of Jesus. Forget that Christ. His name was Jesus. And that's what I call myself a believer of. And the rest of it will shake itself out. You know, but it really, you know, all these things you brought up that we've talked about have, especially the imprisoning of so many people, even with this Sartnov guy doing life 50, 60 years whenever he dies, I think it's cruel and unusual for these people to be in the Supermax in Florence with the restrictions they've got upon them.
Now, okay, you've just opened a door, Kevin, and it is a ripe one for discussion, because this goes to the heart of the constitutional intent of the framers' originalism debate. It's the originalism versus living document debate.
Right.
Obviously, the framers of the Constitution wrote those words, cruel and unusual punishment, in the context of the times in which they lived.
Right, yeah.
Let's understand also that the term capital punishment doesn't mean they take you to Jefferson City or Tallahassee to bump you off in the name of the state.
Right.
It comes from the Latin word for head, because yep. Capital punishment usually involved the separating of one's head from one's neck.
Right.
Which, in Merry Oldie Engeland, also involved taking said head and sticking it on a pointy spike at London Bridge or Tower Bridge or, what, you know, somewhere where everybody would see it. Sometimes they got really vengeful about things. upon the restoration of Charles II to the monarchy in England, they dug up Oliver Cromwell's dead body and beheaded him post-mortem and burned his body. And then his skull was passed around for a few centuries until it was finally buried under some church floor.
Yep.
The urge to vengeance being strong. Now, the framers of the Constitution lived in a time where not only life could be nasty, brutish, and short, but death could come quickly. And so to impose death or impose a criminal punishment, they said in the Constitution that it couldn't be cruel or unusual. Now, they had knowledge of the rack. They had knowledge of drawing and quartering. They had knowledge of all the various and vicious things that the church had done in its oppressive fits from time to time in Europe. And one, I think, may presume they found all of those things cruel and unusual because nobody ever took, and within our own colonial past, they had a very recent memory, especially the New England contingent, of a time when Massachusetts pressed people to death. Giles Corey, I believe, and hanged them. And I don't know, were any of the Salem witches actually burned? I don't think so. I think they were hanged.
Not here in America, no.
Yeah, they were hanged. But you know, they certainly knew of burning at the stake, because that was sanctioned by the church insofar as it did not involve anyone shedding blood. That was the workaround that's why we wound up with burning at the stake. They knew about beheadings. And so, you know, they put that cruel and unusual language in there. Well, if you insist on judging cruel and unusual by the terms of what was cruel and unusual to the framers, not much. And like I said, it's kind of monkey wrenched because it's not cruel or unusual, it's cruel and. You can be cruel without being unusual, you can be unusual without being cruel, and you can still constitutionally get away with it. That's why I argue that crucifixion passes constitutional muster, if you judge it within the context of the time in which it was done. But if the Constitution is a living document, the death penalty becomes almost de facto cruel and unusual. Because we live in an era in which we know that we have for a very long time been putting innocent people who did not commit the crimes of which they were convicted, to death. Now that's I think even the framers in the brutal, you know, no running water, you know, shit in a bowl and throw it out the window times in which they lived would agree that killing somebody for something they didn't do was both cruel and unusual.
Well, who was it back then that said they'd rather a guilty person go free than an innocent person be convicted? I'm paraphrasing, but...
Well, a number of people, I think, have said that. But if you if it's a living document, and you recognize that it's almost impossible to have 100% certainty of guilt, then the risk of convicting an innocent person becomes cruel and unusual. And therefore, you got to get rid of the death penalty. If you measure it by the standards of the rest of the so-called civilized world, it becomes cruel and unusual and has to go. One of the things that I heard put forward by, of all people, Alan Dershowitz, now this is a guy who supports dropping bombs on babies in their cradle in Gaza, mind you, but he pointed out that the jury selection for the Tsarnaev trial was, in his opinion, flawed. And I agree with him. because I thought his reasoning was sound. Because everybody who got onto the Tsarnaev jury had to tell the court that they did not have a problem imposing the death penalty.
Yep.
Even in a state in which the jurors drawn to the jury box were citizens of a commonwealth that bans the practice of the death penalty, of capital punishment. So you can make an argument that the jury that convicted Chokar Tsarnaev was flawed from jump.
Sure. How fair a jury
because,
is it?
So, theoretically, an actual Christian could not sit on that jury. A real Christian, not one of these phony baloney. Yeah, I mean, a follower of the teachings of Yeshua, the brown-skinned Palestinian day laborer and itinerant semi-literate rabbi, could not sit on that jury. The American Conference of Catholic Bishops makes no bones about the fact that it considers the death penalty to be morally wrong. Well, a serious Catholic, then, could not sit on that jury. The Episcopal Church in the United States makes no bones about the fact that it considers the death penalty to be wrong. That means no good Episcopal could have sat on that jury. At least if they follow church teachings. Now, I guess you could have populated that jury with all the Southern Baptists you want. Because, you know, Southern Baptists, man, they love them some death penalty.
But I can't help
but good enough for our Lord. It's good enough for a guy who planted a bomb.
Yeah, but see, that's the thing, what you're saying there. How fair a jury is it if there are no people on the jury who say they would have no trouble imposing a death penalty? What then is left to deliberate if you're going to fairly judge whether or not this man should be put to death? Everybody's already said, I don't have a problem with it. So why shouldn't people who are opposed to the death penalty be on that jury? You know, that would be a more, you know, if you had people who were opposed to the death penalty on that jury and they came back with a recommendation of death, you could make an argument that it was a fair decision because some people's minds were changed. But when the jury pool already says we don't have a problem with it, then, you know, why bother deliberating? You know, you know what it's going to come back as. At least I wouldn't have trouble placing a $2 bet in Vegas on the odds of that, you know. But I think people, for me, death would not be the ultimate punishment that would really haunt me. Spending 50 years in jail thinking about what I did and why I did it and the number of lives I ruined would be a much greater penalty.
But you use the word penalty. And I realize I'm into some pretty deep philosophical weeds, Kevin. But is a penalty what it's about? I mean, it's called the penalty phase. But that's one of the essential discussions this country needs to have and never will. Are we in the punishment business or are we in the protection of the public business? The most viable reason for putting away Chokar Tsarnaev for the rest of his natural life is to protect the public against the likelihood of him ever doing anything else like this again.
Right.
I think there's also an argument to be made that it would probably be wise to do that to protect him from the vengeful mob mentality that seems... I mean, you've got a... you got a woman being paid probably hundreds of thousands of dollars a year to sit in front of a camera and say, I hope he fries.
Yep.
Now, what's the realistic likelihood of Emery and Marveline sitting in front of the TV going, me too, Marveline, me too. And somewhere along the way, some good, God-fearing, upstanding, Bible-believing, evangelical fundamentalist picks up his Second Amendment remedy and goes and takes care of business.
Well, if Alex Jones can convince someone that the killings in Sandy Hook didn't happen, you know, I mean, if there's people out there that believe that that was a false flag operation, how hard would it be to convince someone to take vengeance? And we're coming to that. I actually heard a show last night. They were openly talking about civil war. And
Yeah, we had that last night.
Yeah,
James Dobson says we're going to have a civil war if a couple of guys can pick out a China pattern.
Yep.
The irony being that he said it, you know, a couple of days before the 150th anniversary of the surrender of the last people who started a civil war.
I kind of thinking that wasn't by accident. That's just my personal opinion, but I live in Focus Central, you know, I'm right here, so... It is a conversation I wish our country could have, because what do we call in a large number of places what we put people in prison? We call them correction. We call it corrections. Have you seen
that? But corrections implies that we are attempting to rehabilitate.
Right, exactly. That was my point.
And there is little, any portion of a corrections budget that is rehabilitation in this country, I would hazard a guess, is minuscule.
Yep.
Because, geez, you know what? I think you could argue, Kevin, that decent nutrition probably has something to do with rehabilitation. Because, you know, if they're starving you half to death, that's just going to further embitter you against the system, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
So what of Aramark in Michigan, the story we had a couple of nights ago, who was caught feeding garbage to prisoners?
Yeah.
You know, because of cost-cutting fiscal responsibility.
Yeah. Well, they're getting their billion-dollar contract to incarcerate people. Privately owned prison.
Yeah. I mean, this is... cases like this open up a Gordian knot of real social inquiry. I mean, if we should actually not fry Jokhar Tsarnaev, is there any suggestion that there will be any mode of trying to rehabilitate him? What's the point? He's never getting out.
Right.
Or is this just pure punishment fetish? I mean, for God's sakes, Anders Breivik in Norway, who slaughtered children, will actually be eligible for release from prison in 40 years or so.
Yep.
Yeah, what does that mean? I don't know. As we've seen this evening, there's not many people who would say, yeah, fuck him, kill him. Kill him in my name, it's fine by me. I take that kind of thing seriously, Kevin.
Sure.
I mean, I wasn't a damn thing I could do about it. I mean, I did what I could. I protested. I, I made my voice heard while we were slaughtering a million Iraqis. But you know what? That blood is nonetheless on my hands. Because it was specifically done in my name. In Boston, all the pleadings, the caption of the pleadings, say, the people of the United States of America versus Chokhar Tsarnaev. That's you, Kevin. That's me.
Sure.
That's every last ever-loving one of us. You know what? It doesn't even say the free citizens. The free people of the United States of America. Jesus, that these cases are brought not merely in the names of the people who are out on the streets. They're brought in the names of people who are in prison, for God's sakes. And this is not just some legal formality. This is the essential nature of our judicial system.
Yeah.
And at what point in time, and God knows the idea terrifies me, do you have any doubt, Kevin, this country being this country? Do you have any doubt that were the death penalty to be subjected to a national referendum, say on a presidential ballot, that an overwhelming majority of the people of the United States would say, yeah, let's have us, let's make you, it's the law of the land.
Well, I have no doubt that organizations like ALEC would sure be pouring money into it to make sure it was. There would be many more commercials on TV applauding and urging people to vote for it, which, of course, sways people to cast their votes a certain way, money being speech in their minds, which it, I guess it is, as much as I don't want to admit it for, you know, that's the nature of our country today. Yep.
I mean, you see, this is not, for me, this is not just a parlor game.
No.
And this is not the esoterics of how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. This is an essential inquiry as to the nature of who we are as a country. And if Andrea Tarantula is to be believed, we are a country who likes to fry people. Man, she wants to hear him sizzling and a popping, doesn't she? She wants him to use old Sparky, not any horizontal crucifixion. You know, it is pathetic. Let's remember when Chokhar Tsarnaev committed these acts of which he's been convicted. He was 17 years old.
Right.
There was a time in this country when that would have conferred upon him juvenile status.
Yep.
Presumptively. And there would have had to have been a motion put before the court to treat him as an adult. I don't think the prosecution in this case even had to jump through that hoop. Because we live in a country that, given its choice in many states, has executed minors, children, has executed the developmentally delayed, the insane. I mean, one disastrously mentally ill man in Texas is still hanging on by a legal fingernail, is he not? Remember the guy who showed up in court as John Wayne?
Oh, yeah.
Subpoenaed God?
Yeah.
Yeah. It ain't easy. Kevin, have yourself a good evening. Thank you for the thought-provoking inquiry. I do appreciate it.
Thank you, Bob, and I'll be here tomorrow night.
All right, you take care now. Bye.
Take care.
Our buddy Kevin calling from Colorado Springs. Steve from New York City with a note. If you look at Matthew 25, the judgment scene, there's nothing in there about what anyone believed. It all boiled down to what people did. And there you have it. The Gizmo line, 304-663-HORN, is open. Let's run over to Harold, formerly known as the Skype line. Hey, Jim.
Hey, Mog.
What's happening?
Oh, I just wanted to share just a couple things quickly with you.
Okay.
When I first started teaching school, it was the first school I taught at, and I had this girl in my class, and she came up to me and said, I've got to go home, and I've got to cut your class. And, of course, if I had signed the cut slip that she left, she would have been suspended. And I just said, well, Chris, why do you need to do this? She said, I've got a lid under the bed. My sister just called me, and her sister was on the Supreme Court of South Carolina. Okay?
Yeah.
And
a lid, as in weed?
Of marijuana.
Yeah.
And she said, I've got to get over there before she finds it. And knowing the family, I knew what the mother would do. It would have been pretty draconian. So I just said, Chris, go with God. See you tomorrow. So that was the kind of decision of power that I had. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah. And the humane exercise thereof.
Second time I had this decision was the guy stole my car. I just parked it out in front of a friend's house to go in to do something, and I left keys in the car. And so when I got the car back and had to go down to the magistrate's office, and they explained to me, you know, what was going on. I didn't know if he had any priors or whatever. I went to see the guy. The bar is between him and me.
Yeah.
But, you know, he didn't really express any type of contrition whatsoever. And then, of course, I had to sign a document that I would prosecute. And I signed it. Because I just thought, well, you know, this guy needs to be taught a lesson. And he can go through PTI or something like that. But he needs to go through a judicial process in which he will realize the gravity of what he's done. And he was over 21.
Was he stealing it to be permanently stealing it, or was he joyriding?
Joyriding, I think. The vehicle was recovered. But my decision was based upon my personal interaction with him. And I said, well, you know, it's a time for me to let the courts go through the process. If this is his first offense, then he can go through pretrial intervention and learn the error of his ways. And perhaps that would teach him a lesson not to jump into a car because he happened to see a key in the ignition. Because it's not right to steal anybody's vehicle, and you know that.
Absolutely.
And the third time I had a position of power was at Fort Jackson over a soldier. I was a lot older then. I was in my 40s, early 40s. And she had signed what they call a DA Form 2173, which gave access to a lot of federal money for school. And she was an E5. She knew better. Black girl. And the education officer at the fort called me because I was under a different MACOM. She was, and by that I mean Major Army Command. So the education officer who was under what they call a TRADOC, or Training and Doctor Command, called me and said, Jim, is this your signature? So I went down there and said, no, it's not. And I said, well, what do you want me to do? He said, no, the power rests with you. He didn't care to play Pontius Pilate.
Yeah.
So So I called her in my office, and I said, ma'am, what do you have to say for yourself? And her excuse was, well, I didn't think you would mind. I said, do you realize that right above where you signed, it states under UCMJ what the penalties are, that this is going to wreck your career? Not only are you going to have to make restitution, you're probably going to go to jail. And it will ruin your life. So I took the document, I thought about it, and I told her to wait outside, and I thought, well, what can I do? So I called her back in, and I said, I want to tear this thing up, but I want you to realize exactly what you do when you sign somebody else's name to a document, and you commit what's called forgery. And I said, this is not a state thing. This is a federal thing. This is Uniform Code of Military Justice.
This is Leavenworth stuff.
Exactly. I tore it up. And I said, I hope you've learned a lesson from this. Because if you haven't, the next person who may have this authority will not be as merciful.
And see, you were exercising a level of discretion there, Jim, that, for instance, in the federal judicial system, the Congress has done a bang-up job of taking away from federal judges, which is a bit ironic in that they're lifetime appointed, and we put them into those positions because we consider them to be near enough a living solon to sit in judgment of an entire district of a state, sometimes an entire state. And so that's why you wind up with well, for instance, in federal court, the conviction rate in trials is somewhere near 100%.
I knew that, and I knew that it would ruin her life and her career. And I could transform a viable human being into a criminal who probably would never recover from it. And I just could not do that. I tore it up. I told her to never come back to me again for any help whatsoever. And she was transferred into another facility where she could have access to the same document and the same privileges. I said, do not ever do this again, because you will wind up in a federal prison for this, and you will have no career. And wherever you go, this is going to be on your record, and no one will touch you as far as job application or anything else is concerned, because you are well beyond the age and you are an E5 staff sergeant. And, you know, I never regretted having done that.
No. No.
I just hope that when I appear before my own bar of justice, that someone will show me at least a modicum of largesse and mercy.
Well, there's a great big gap you can drive a truck through between justice and mercy, isn't there?
Right. But the quality of mercy is not strained.
It falleth as the gentle rain from heaven upon the just and the unjust.
Right. And so I've never regretted that act. And boy, you me, that guy down the street who brought that to my attention, he was raring and willing to go to let her have it. He said, it's going to take your signature on this, or your initiative. I'm going to pass this on to you. I said, okay. And I don't think he and I ever talked about it again. He said, what did you do with Staff Sergeant so-and-so? I said, I took care of it in the best possible way. And that was the end of that, but
Jim, I'm gonna ask you a question that, if it's uncomfortable, I apologize, and you can pass on it, but, you know, you've shared certain aspects of your life with the community over the years. You were serving in a military that was not forgiving of some of those aspects of your life.
Absolutely not.
Did that color your decision-making process, do you think?
It did. Because you're not hauled before any jury or whatever. You're hauled before a tribunal, or in certain cases, it depends on the level of the offense, whether they have some type of constituted jury or whatever. But nonetheless, in this situation, I'm not sure where it would have gone. It probably would have gone before a tribunal, and they would not have been merciful. I knew. I certainly knew that. And having worked around the military and in the military, I just couldn't do it. I would not do it. I would not ruin another person's life for one indiscretion. But I can guarantee you one thing. We certainly had what they call a come to Jesus meeting. And I did the very best I could to scare the absolute dickens out of her. I wasn't mad.
No,
wasn't
but did she continue to serve in the same command you were in, or?
She was transferred shortly thereafter.
I thought I would update you.
Her orders came through, I signed off on them, and I said I just want to get her out of here. Let her go to somebody else and let's see what she's going to do. Because I didn't want any type of prejudice or whatever to remain behind based upon my decision.
Reasonable.
I'm like everybody else. I get pissed off. I get vindictive and then I have to think about, what will the consequences of my actions be? And how would I like to be treated if I were on the other side of the desk? And, of course, in certain other situations, I was on the other side of the desk in situations, and people were not so understanding.
No. And I think within the larger context of the conversation we're having this evening, I find it interesting that the numbers are running, last I checked, about 80-20 in favor of life in prison for Mr. Tsarnaev over death penalty.
Well, you know,
oddly enough, people out in other parts of the country are screaming for his blood.
I understand that. And here's another situation. I had a soldier who was wounded at Fort Bragg. He had a back injury. Had a doctor call me. I was a medical actions officer, and the doctor wanted to move him, get him out of there. And I told that doctor, I said, "You will not get my, I will not sign this paper to that will agree to that." And then, of course, my boss, this colonel, came to me and said, "Well, why didn't you take care of that? You don't represent that soldier. You represent the government." And told me that he wouldn't forget that either. Because what had happened in the meanwhile, the senior army advisor who outranked him told him, he said, "This man did what was right. That soldier should never have been moved." And that guy hated me for the rest of the time that I was there. And took it out of me too. You don't represent that soldier. You represent the government.
Yeah, brother.
I said, no, I represent the welfare of a soldier who was hurt in the line of duty. Yet you want him thrown out with a back injury, put out of a military treatment facility in which he may not have received adequate care. Oh, that was a real stinger, Bob. It really was.
About how long ago was that?
1993.
And
it was 1991. It was right after Desert Storm.
So the VA issues, it's not something that just cropped up recently.
No, it's been going on for a long time. And of course, you know, all they had this disease. They're called sandfly disease or leishmaniasis. I'm sure you've heard of it.
Oh yeah.
And you don't drink the nasty water in Southwest Asia. But here's the thing: they would send bottles over there of bottled water that were pure, and then I found out that they were refilling them with some water from those damn wells.
Mm-mm-mm. Another good reason to stay out of there.
Sir?
Another good reason to stay out of there.
Yes, sir. But that wasn't my decision to stay out of it. I was there. I was being paid, and I did the best I could to protect people and help them in any way I possibly could. And a lot of people above me didn't feel that way. They just felt like they were pieces of flotsam and jetsam to be cast upon whatever sea of indecision or lack of humanity they could. And some of the things I saw just broke my heart. But it was above my pay grade. But in those situations, it wasn't above my pay grade. The soldier was taken care of. The girl went on to do whatever she did, and I wish her the very best still. The young man who took my car didn't express any contrition, and I thought maybe the system might benefit him. And, of course, the young lady in my class, that could have caused her so much trouble. And I just could not hurt her in any way. Because, hell, I was smoking it myself.
Well, there we go.
So there are lots of elements that enter into a decision-making process. And I don't know if this has had any impact really upon you guys have been talking about, but it's just a personal experience.
Well, no, it's real time and real world. And the thing is, anybody who has a loved one in the system, and I'm not necessarily talking about Joe Karsarnaev, no matter how badly they may have screwed up, family tends to pray, hope against hope, that there will be some mercy meted out and not mere vengeance. Because...
Certainly, of course. And then, of course, you have the families of the other victims and of the picture who really are howling for this guy's blood. But I thought, and I said last night, I would not kill him. I would put him into Supermax and he could have the rest of his life to contemplate the gravity.
Well, that's Sarnaev. Of course, yeah. the guy in South Carolina, I don't even know where the big house is in South Carolina. You may.
Used to be that, believe it or not, the original big house dated back from the Civil War in Columbia. It's called CCI, or Central Correction Institution. And hell, Sherman stabled his horses there. I mean, you can imagine what that place looked like.
Well, and the thing is, federal, I know people who work within the federal system, or work in both systems, doing, for instance, counseling and substance abuse work, that kind of thing. And they will tell you to a man that as between the two, there's not a state in the union whose, penal system you want to be in rather than the federal system. The federal system is no cakewalk.
No, sir, it's not.
But the state system is a million times more brutal. You know, witness the story out of Michigan that we had this week, or any of the given horrors that have come out of the penitentiary in Florida or Angola, Louisiana, or...
Oh, well, God, yeah.
Well, I mean, Mount Olive, West Virginia, and before that, Moundsville.
Right. Well, you can imagine what type of penal system exists in South Carolina.
I can well imagine.
And it's hardly, you know, there is no effort toward rehabilitation. It's all punitive. None of it is positive.
Right, and compare that with the story out of Norway from a few weeks back, where they've got prisons that don't even look like prisons, and everybody who comes out of it has a marketable skill, has focused on rehabilitation, and they bust their ass to get people back into society safely and legally.
With a very low, very low recidivism.
Yeah, their recidivism rate. Yeah, their recidivism rate is like south of 20%.
Not so in South Carolina.
Oh hell no.
Not so in America.
Because we have designed a prison system that is.
It's circulatory.
It's not
right back in here.
And it's also a spiral. It's criminal university.
Of course, I mean if you go in there with a high school diploma in crime, you're going to come out, and most of them, at least with a master's degree or the equivalent thereof, or a PhD in criminal behavior and activity. That's where they learn it. So it's,
and then the next generation is taught on the street by people who have been released having completed the master class.
Right. You know, there was a good book we talked about before. It's called Cruel and Unusual Punishment by Jessica Minford, in which it'll show you how certain portions of the prison populations are treated. Drug companies use them for chimpanzees. There is a chapter in that book, chapter 4, I think, called Cheaper Than Chimpanzees. And in order for prisoners to get, like, extra chewing gum and extra privileges at their I'll call it a PX or their
canteen.
Right. That they allow themselves to be used as guinea pigs. And I know there was one medication called Prolixin. And you can look it up on the internet. I've forgotten what it does, but it has to do with neurological ramifications. And the results of that particular drug just caused horrible pain, deterioration of the femoral nerve sheath. And I've never forgotten that book.
Jesus. Well, Jim, it's been a good conversation, and I thank you very kindly.
Well, I hope that the little I've shared will have some impact on whatever you're doing. And, you know, it's just my opinion, just part of my life experience.
Well, okay? it's part of the ongoing community and the ongoing community's attempt to comprehend, understand, process, and I appreciate you being part of it, Jim.
All right. You're certainly welcome. You have a good evening. You have a good program.
Going to try. You take care. Bye now.
All right. Out here.
Our buddy Jim. And from Jim to Jim in Louisiana Stan. Hey, Jim.
What's up, Bob?
Hey, let me thank you right off the bat. I appreciate it. We all do.
I appreciate it. I owed you that 50, so I just doubled it, sent it in, figured out that got the card to work, so everything was cool. Probably, hopefully, the last one I sent you from Louisiana Stan. So,
yeah, the next thing we're going to hear is a postcard in the mailbox that Boss Man Wayne can pull out. You know, greetings from Colorado.
Yep, that'll do.
Maybe with a picture of a big old green bud on the front, a legal one.
Something like that. Yeah, well, that's amazing. But I hear like a couple other states are considering decriminalizing it too.
Well, I mean, you've got Oregon. You've got Washington State. Technically, you've got D.C., but they
Congress won't let them.
They monkey wrenched it in such a way that it's essentially meaningless. You can possess it, you can own it, but you can't smoke it anywhere in public, you can't smoke it in the federal areas, and you can't buy it or sell it.
Yeah. That's
some kind of legal, isn't it?
I'm sure the booze industry is trying to do everything they can to stop it.
I don't know. I think you'd have to sell a whole bunch of weed in D.C. to even take a tiny little nibble out of the booze market. I'm not kidding. You can't go anywhere in that city, it seemed like, at least that was my experience, without there being a liquor store about every four doors.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, yeah. All over the place.
Yeah, well, it's kind of like that in New Orleans, but, you know, where I'm living, Covington or St. Tammany, it's a lot, you know, it's people come here to get away from, you know, the evil New Orleans and the crime, too, although I guess it's kind of gone down, but then there's still...
I don't know. There's something about New Orleans that makes me say, lead me into temptation.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I will never forget being down there and just, you know, being able to, you know, it was early Saturday morning, being able to stroll down the street with a Bloody Mary in hand, you know, not stumbling or falling down, but just, you know, having a cocktail and taking in the sights.
Yeah, it's in the French Quarter. Yeah, while there are certain areas, just like anywhere else.
Is it still legal in Louisiana, Stan? Can you still drive through and get a booze slushy, you know, in the car?
Not really, but you can. In fact, there's a daiquiri shop not too far from here, and people drive up. They get it. They get it. Now they're not drink. You know, it's pretty close to where I live, but they can go up, get a, I don't know, 48, 64 ounce. Daiquiri, or buy a fifth of Jack Daniels or whatever and just get in your car. You know, nothing's stopping you from drinking it, you know, as soon as you want. Yeah, except maybe your better judgment, you know.
Well, yeah. I'm a firm believer in walking.
Yeah.
Because that particular Saturday morning was the Saturday before the night that the Mountaineers played the Bayou Bengals. It was a frustrating football game, but, you know, just to get up and walk around the quarter when, you know, nobody, I mean, everybody's all passed out and still asleep. Whole quarter was asleep. And, had me a Bloody Mary walking around in search of a bowl of morning gumbo, and the server in the one little place I walked into right off Jackson Square looked at me like I had three heads, but I got me a bowl of gumbo.
Is it good?
Oh my God, it was wonderful. You know, the server looked at me like I was nuts, but at the same time she smiled and called me Cher, so I knew I knew I was in New Orleans.
Yeah, but the thing we were talking about the goes back to the prison industrial complex. It's just a fake industry for corporations to. And the thing is, they privatize it, whereas if they ran it publicly, or if it was government-run, they could do more for the people who commit the crimes and maybe lower the recidivism rate, juxtaposed to where the only function of the capitalist model is to just keep 90% or whatever the quota is in jail, right?
Well, somebody's got, once you've gone capitalist on your prison system, somebody's got to be in them beds. Because it turns, and to even discuss it in those terms, Jim, is so upside down, backwards, and crazy, that it's hard to contemplate. But yeah, the other thing is, if the state's running everything, well, your daggum prison guards, they got a retirement and a pension and health care.
Yeah. God, this capitalism, it really pisses me off to no end just how destructive it is. I don't want to the people, but its own self in the long run. And I don't mean a very long one. I mean, am I just being delusional? I mean, to me, I just see nothing but...
Well, that's like something Dr. Bill and I were discussing, I think, yesterday. I horned in. See what I did there? I horned into his program because he was talking about Thomas Piketty and his book. And one of the things that I noted is that, you know, Marx posited a theory, and if I'm getting it wrong, maybe somebody like Dr. John will correct me because he knows it much better than I. But Marx figured that the working class would eventually get to the point where they were so disgusted with being used and abused that they would rise up, you know, it would be a middle class revolution, and they would throw off the chains of the capitalist oppressors. But if America teaches us anything, it is that at least here in Merca, people will put up with anything. I guess as long as, I've said in the past, Jim, the cable is on.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe they'll win the lottery, or maybe they'll get that promotion to the quote-unquote lower mid-level management job, and then maybe they'll last till they're 45 or 50, and then all of a sudden they'll say, well, you've been doing fine, but we're going to let you go. Have a nice life.
Yeah.
I'm done. You were talking about that the other day about with what's her name? About now she works three jobs and you basically do, but you're doing a radio. But as far as going out and getting a job, even with your computer skills and whatnot, nobody's going to hire you full time.
No, the reason being. If you're going to hire somebody, you want to hire somebody young so you can pay them next to no money, and because they're young enough that they don't have the life experience to look at the betters and say, you know, you're full of shit. Do it yourself.
Yeah.
And I guess that's part of what makes me a potential bad employee, because Jim, it's not that I don't suffer fools gladly. I don't suffer fools. You know, somebody wants to be a fool, they can be one on their own time.
Yeah, well, like the job I was working out here, I mean, believe me, I dealt with, it wasn't glamorous. It was all right sometimes, but then sometimes just people just have this attitude, and it was just incredible. I'm sure they got that everywhere, so I'll find out what it's like in Denver, so we'll see. But, yeah, but the whole prison industrial complex, that's, I don't see how we're going to get out of it. I mean, I can remember when I was in college, starting college, so it's 77, early, late 70s, and taking poli-sci courses or something, or maybe it was, I guess it was Poli-Sci, but they were actually trying to have a debate whether or not punishment was whether reason for jail or prison was to rehabilitate a punishment, you know, and ideally it would be for rehabilitation, like you pointed out in Europe. I mean, geez, and Pete, that seems much more enlightened over there than over here. Although I can understand the anger of people, and you know, I've been ripped off and robbed, and you do feel vengeful, you know. But
well, the only way you say I don't see how we ever change it. The only way we ever change it is with a significant re-understanding of the meaning of the Constitution. And I like to think, Jim, that I'm not like those right-wingers who, you know, oh, I'm a strict constitutionalist, and it says right there in the Constitution, one nation under God. I'm not those people. But I do have enough of a working understanding of the Constitution to know that we've just about interpreted it right out from under itself. between, you know, between Fat Tony Scalia and his originalism and the centuries-long assault now on the very simple and plain words of the Fourth Amendment and good faith exceptions and that kind of thing. Now, the Constitution has been shoehorned into the imperial state.
Yeah, and a little bit I know about that is I remember taking another course where it was kind of like, or maybe I've just picked this up over the years, whether the interpretation is quote unquote the original meaning. Or a more evolved, advanced, advanced one, what we've learned works and doesn't work. I definitely don't go with the original meaning, because first of all, that's 200 years ago. You have no idea. They didn't hit the technology, blah, 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 and a ton of things. So I think the originalism, I think that's bullshit. I mean, you got to look at it. They didn't have cars back then, you know. They didn't have planes.
And you know, there are, as we've learned from Dr. Bill, and continue to learn, you know, there are places where the framers said quite plainly what they intended, what they meant for something to mean. And when you've got that, you can certainly, if you're doing analysis of the issue, you can say, well, that's what they intended. But even their intent does not necessarily control the application of modern facts to the Constitution as it stands in the modern world. Make any sense?
Yeah, it's just mind-boggling, you know. To me, maybe I just see certain things so clear. To me, I mean, not clear, because I definitely see the more murkiness of what that guy did. I think that was I didn't catch the total beginning of your show, but I think you were talking about the
Tsarnaev, yeah.
And like you said, I mean, 30 life sentences or whatever. Okay, so he's definitely not going to get out. Or his first killing, I could see just letting him rot away in prison. Although the other, a while back, and I was thinking another good way to do it is, but this would be a real cruel punishment. You just have a guard come up and shoot him when they're not expecting it, just like they did to their, alleged victim. They're victims, or alleged victims, since you never know 100% if somebody's guilty. Or, well, most of the time. But, you know, that's just too bizarre. But, yeah, I find it hard to just go with the, the death penalty. So, well, I hope my little tip in there helped out. I'm going to let you go.
Jim, let me make clear. It was huge. We started the program with a $175 deficit, and now we only have a $75 deficit thanks to you.
All right. Well, I'll get some other Hondanistas out there throwing some little money. What is it, 25 at 5, 3 at 25?
Yeah, you probably can do the ciphering and gazentas better than me.
Yeah, I've got an OCD with math. That just pops in my head almost like a computer.
That is definitely not me.
All right, Bob.
All right, Jim. Thanks again so much, and you have a good evening. Bye now. Our buddy Jim in Louisiana Stan, from Jim to Jim. Both lines are open, 304-574-8178 or 304-663-PORN, 304-663-4676. I thought we might check out a little bit of audio. Isaac sent this along to me earlier this evening. Last night, as we discussed the killing of Walter Scott, the murder, do I have to say gruesome? I don't think so. The murder of Walter Scott in North Charleston, South Carolina, we were asking questions about how did the two people wind up in that green space back behind the pawn shop. I checked, I found Megapawn of North Charleston, South Carolina on Google Earth last night. I like to do that kind of thing, get a sense of where something's happening. And we know a little bit more now about how the situation came to be what it was. Because SLED, the State Law Enforcement Division, has released the dash cam video from Officer Slager's roller. There is some audio involved as well. Just a second. I'm on. Yeah, here we go. Just as quick as the commercial is over, had to restart it. If you want to see this, it is at WISTV, WISTV.com. The headline, is, well, here we go. So Officer Slager's listening to the radio. He pulls up behind Mr. Scott's automobile. Gee, I wonder why they've got the music playing loud. I wonder why a police officer would have the music in his car playing loud enough that it makes it difficult to hear things. Do you wonder? I wonder. Asked him for his license and his insurance card.
What's that? Okay, let's start with your license. Reason for the stop is your third brake light's out.
The reason I stopped you is your third brake light's out. We had that discussion. If you stop somebody because their third brake light's out, as a police officer, you're up to something. Because you can, of course, run plates while you're behind a car, just depending on how far you're willing to follow. Let's continue.
Okay.
In amongst all the radio play, which is curious, isn't it? A discussion about whether or not there's insurance on this four-door Mercedes sedan.
You don't have any paperwork in the glove box? No registration in there? No insurance? What is it? Okay. But you're buying the car?
Yes, sir.
Did you already buy it?
No, not yet. I'm about to buy it.
Okay, it's a minute ago you told me that you bought it. Well, and you're saying everything over on Monday.
I'm sorry about that.
All right. I'll be right back with you.
All right, I'll be right back with you. He turns, he walks away from the car, begins looking over his shoulder, back at Mr. Scott's automobile. Gets back in the cruiser. Turns the music down. Hey, can anybody identify the music? I'm just curious because I'm nerdy that way. Just wondering. Sounds vaguely familiar. Okay, here's where the trouble starts. Mr. Scott opens the driver's side door and begins to step out.
Get in the car.
Get back in the car. He gets back in the car. You know, it's hard to watch and it's hard to hear because you know what comes next. Sort of like a Greek tragedy that way. Only Greek tragedies are plays, and this is no play. This is the opening overture to the end of a life. And he opens the door, the driver's side door, and takes off running. That noise is wind passing across the microphone as he chases Mr. Scott. And this is how they get in that grassy space.
Taser, taser, taser!
Taser, taser, taser. Do you hear the clacking of the taser there? Yeah. Get on the ground. Get on the ground. That's it. Taser, taser, get on the ground. And then a life ends. A life is ended. Mr. Scott is murdered. As I said yesterday evening, a charge of murder is not the same thing as an indictment for murder. An indictment for murder is not the same thing as a trial for murder. A trial for murder is not the same thing as a conviction for murder. A conviction for murder is not the same thing as incarceration for murder. Why did Mr. Scott run? Well, what is known now, and what is being spread around via the media, is that there was a bench warrant out for Mr. Scott's arrest because of unpaid child support. Again, if you want to see the video for yourself, it's at WISTV.com. The story is headlined, "Dash Cam Video from Michael Slager's Patrol Car Released," by Jeremy Turnage. It was released today at 11:22 a.m. By the way, the song is "What It's Like." Not that this makes much difference. by a band called Everlast. Oddly enough, the song features characters including a beggar, a pregnant girl who decides to have an abortion, and a drug dealer named Max. Thank you, Devin. And thank you, Michael, in Madison. Oh, by the way, I found out via News Ninja Carol Baker that while, I want to get this right, the usual police Uber Alles types started a couple of legal defense crowdfunding campaigns. GoFundMe, the one at GoFundMe, has been pulled. Indiegogo, thus far, despite thousands of protests, Indiegogo refuses to take down the Michael Slager legal defense crowdfunding campaign. So far in 2 days, the campaign at Indiegogo has raised $1,241. Tells you a little bit, doesn't it, about Indiegogo. You remember when George Zimmerman murdered Trayvon Martin? Well, I'm still waiting for the equivalent of good shooting Zim to come out in right-wing media in this case. But, see, I'll bet you that I could go to the state code of South Carolina and look up the criminal statute for non-payment of child support, and I'll bet you that if I went and found that statute, and that in examining that statute, I'll bet that if I found the punishment portion of that statute, that I would not find that failure to pay child support carries the death penalty, even in South Carolina. One other observation. I'll bet you, no, I won't, I mean, it's just a phrase. I suspect that the South Carolina failure to pay child support statute probably has language, this isn't a quote, I don't have it in front of me, but it probably has language similar to a person under an order to pay child support who does not pay child support and is reasonably able to do so shall be deemed guilty of a, and I'll bet you it's a misdemeanor, because you gotta stiff your kids several times over usually before it becomes a felony. Same thing with domestic battery. You gotta beat on somebody you ostensibly love, at least in this state, several times before you wind up being charged with a felony. 3, I think. Just like DUI, you gotta drive drunk 3 times in this state before you're charged with a felony. So 50-year-old Walter Scott had a bench warrant out for him for failure to pay child support. And here's where we see one of those delineations between the haves and the have-nots in this country. That phrase, and again, maybe it's not in the South Carolina statute, but given that most legislatures are comprised of mostly men, and it is mostly men who wind up having to pay child support, I seriously suspect that that reasonably able language is in the statute because it's in a bunch of them, or something similar. Because it provides a way out of the charge for anyone who can afford a good enough lawyer to make the argument. See, if you are economically privileged enough to hire that lawyer, even if they bust you on the bench warrant, you're going to be out, especially if you're white. You're going to be out of jail, probably on your own recognizance. At the very most, you'll post some sort of minimal bond, and you'll be back out on the streets until you have a preliminary hearing. And even if you take it to a jury trial in small claims court, misdemeanor, whatever, then you stand there in front of the jury and you argue, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, my client is behind on his child support. But he has not failed to pay it. He is simply not reasonably able to do it at this time. And as the court has told you, before you can convict, you must find that he is reasonably able to pay it. And daddy will maybe walk. Some states have tried the tactic of putting daddy in the clink until he comes up with the cash, but most times the court will say it's better off if daddy is out working and will garnish his wages. Or a lawyer can negotiate a payment schedule or a modification. But Walter Scott runs because Walter Scott is black. And Walter Scott doesn't have access to anybody who can tell him the kinds of things that I have just suggested here. Now, what I've just suggested is not legal advice. I'm not telling anyone to not pay their child support, or that if they're not paying their child support, that they won't get in hot water. But hot water itself, and one not need be Perry Mason in order to know this, in Merca, hot water itself is different when a person of color is in it than when a person of pale privilege is in it. And moreover, hot water is hotter for someone regardless of skin color privilege. Water is hotter when someone does not have the economic privilege to be in it. So what we have here is still what we had here last night and when the story broke. A man who was summarily executed for running away from a police officer, whatever his reason. Oh, and by the way, there is an argument to be had. That this whole miserable event need not have happened. By the way, I apologize if this has trigger components for anyone, because Michael in Madison said, I haven't watched the video yet because I just can't. This is the first time I've heard the audio. I'm taking deep breaths. As for the song, I was already on it. I instantly recognized What It's Like by Everlast, and the horrible irony of that song playing during this nightmare come to life instantly grabbed me. Michael said, that's the cop's radio? Yeah, he was listening to the radio in the car. He was listening to that song? Yeah, he was listening to a radio station that was playing that song. They got some good radio stations down along the Carolina coast. Beach music, things like that. But because I'm a bit of a, I don't know, paranoid? I mean, we're not talking Alex Jones paranoid or anything, but a bit of a paranoid. I can see where having the radio blaring at 90 damn decibels inside your cruiser could come in handy. If you're afraid of something showing up on your recording. Because the dash cam is rolling and the mic is on. And yet, as you may have noted, and whatever you heard at the other end of the stream is very similar to what I heard here, the conversation between Mr. Scott and Officer Slager is muddied at best by virtue of the overplay of the music on the radio. Barbie also recognized the song almost instantly. My knowledge of pop music goes sideways somewhere in the late 90s. I think it had something to do with the geezer gene kicking in. Regardless, another story has emerged in North Charleston. A man named Mario Givens gave an interview to the Associated Press, who's published the story. Yesterday, Mario Givens told the Associated Press about something that happened to him in the pre-dawn hours of September, a date in September of 2013. Everybody was asleep when someone began banging on the door of their home in North Charleston, South Carolina. When Mario Givens answered the door, he saw standing before him a North Charleston Police Department officer who, it turns out, was in fact Michael Thomas Slager. Mario Givens was just in a pair of boxer shorts and a T-shirt. You know, it's night. People are in bed. It probably goes without saying that Mario Givens is also a man of color. And he opens the door and asks Officer Slager what he wants. Officer Slager says, I want to come in. He didn't say, I have a warrant. He didn't say, may I come in? He didn't say that he was looking for anyone in particular. And having said, I want to come in, he shoved the door in and looked at Mario Givens and said, come outside or I'll tase you. Mario Givens said, I didn't want that to happen to me, being tased. So I raised my arms over my head, and when I did, he tased me in my stomach anyway. The pain from being tased was so intense that he dropped to his knees and he began calling for his mama. That's when a second officer entered the house, and the two of them dragged Mario Givens out into the yard and threw him onto the ground, handcuffed him, and stuffed him into the back of a North Charleston Police Department squad car. For doing all of these things, or not doing anything, which is more aptly descriptive, Mario Givens was charged with resisting arrest. I guess by falling to his knees when he got tased. Or perhaps asking, why do you want to come in my house? In the hours before dawn. His mama, Bessie Givens, is 57 years old, and she said, It was very devastating. You watch your son like that. He's so vulnerable. You don't know what's going to happen. I was so scared, with good reason, because the police do this in black communities all over America and in communities of color where they don't have black people to pick on. They'll pick on a Latino community. If they don't have a Latino community, they'll pick on an Asian community. Barring anything else, they'll just pick on the poor whites. Now, it turns out that Michael Slager was there because of a complaint made by a woman about another individual, Matthew Givens. Little 5'5" fella, as compared to Mario Givens, who is over 6 feet tall. Malia Kiara Brown had given a description of Matthew Givens to the police. She said, he looked nothing like the description I gave the officers. He asked the officer why he was at the house. He did it nicely. The police, because she was watching it all happen. He did it nicely. The police officer said he wanted him to step outside. Then he asked, why? Why do you want me to step outside? And the officer barged in and grabbed him. All this time, Ms. Brown is screaming, you've got the wrong man, you've got the wrong man, you've got the wrong man. Eventually, she said, why did you tase him? And the cop told her to get back. Describing Michael Slager, Ms. Brown said he was cocky. It looked like he wanted to hurt him. There was no need to tase him, no reason. He was no threat. We told him he had the wrong man. So rather than take it, Mario Givens went downtown to the police department and actually filed a formal complaint. The neighbors who saw it all go down contacted the North Charleston Police Department. But they say, consistently, that the North Charleston Police Department was not interested in taking their statements. By way of explaining why they roughed up Mario Givens, Michael Slager wrote a report saying that he couldn't see one of Mr. Givens' hands and he feared that he might be holding a weapon. Cops are always afraid somebody's holding a weapon. And he said that he observed sweat on Givens' shirt. And he thought that that was evidence that he may have just run from Ms. Brown's home, because the entire thing developed when
she said that Matthew Givens, who is 5'5", to Mario Givens, 6 feet plus, she woke up and found him in her bedroom, you know, looking at her, which is creepy. Slager also said in his report that he entered the home to prevent the subject from fleeing, and then was forced to use his stun gun when Givens struggled against him. In the report, Michael Slager says that Mario Givens, 6 feet plus, looks just like Matthew Givens, 5 feet five. After a couple of weeks of letting the case lay around and ignoring it real good, the North Charleston Police Department dismissed, closed the case, and noted that Officer Slager had been exonerated. Mario Givens was never contacted by the North Charleston Police Department in the course of the internal investigation. 6 weeks later, he went to the police department to find out if anything was happening. He said, oh, yeah, something happened. Case is closed. Asked by the Associated Press, Mario Givens said of the murder of Walter Scott, it could have been prevented if they had just listened to me and investigated what happened that night. This man might be alive today. And it kind of punctuates the idea that had Mr. Santana not gone public with the video he took, that this too would have been another case of a recalcitrant Negro resisting arrest and having to be killed, having gone after Officer Slager's taser, or maybe his gun. Jim asks, what is the difference of what you described between the night and fog decree used by the Gestapo in 1941? The language involved? Otherwise, not much? And see, Carol's right there. Come on, Bob, they all look alike to this cop. Wrong man? How can you tell? We have a cop problem in the United States of America. Unfortunately, we have a cop problem that every time we try to talk about it, winds up getting obfuscated by a bunch of people who say, yeah, but most of the police officers is hard-working, good people doing a dangerous, dangerous job. Well, that's not the cops we're talking about. We have a cop problem born out of authoritarianism, born out of nascent fascism, which is why Jim asked the question he asked, and Arthur points out from the chat room, stop, or I'll feel threatened. Bingo. They feel threatened every morning they come, they get up and go to work because they are scared of the people they are supposed to protect. They presume that we are all guilty. And it's time to get out of here in a hurry. Thank you, Ron. Thank you very kindly for adding to the evening's total. We end the program only $50 away from the evening's, $50 from getting out of the hole. That means we'll start the evening tomorrow night, hopefully an epic Friday on the front porch, with $200 to go in fundraising. Thank you to all of you who make all of this go. Those of you who spend, even without calling or emailing or tweeting or Facebooking or anything, spend finite, precious time, genial time, community time,
joining in the conversation. Thank you for your calls, your emails, your tweets, your Facebook posts. Thank you to our all-volunteer staff. Thank you to those of you who keep this effort underway, alive and kicking, and have for 10 years. Thank you. And with time already long run out, I'll simply say, Gina, always, it's all for you. And good night until Friday on the front porch. Bye now.